Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for coming out this afternoon. My name is Melanie O'Brien, and I am the acting director and curator here at the Belkin. And welcome to this conversation between Marianne Nicholson and Gord Hill on the occasion of this exhibition, which is on its last day. This is an emergency broadcast, a project with Marianne Nicholson. And the project is one that Marianne has been, it's a node on a longer series of projects that takes up ongoing Indigenous activism, gathering, and resistance. And this particular moment looks at six moments in history, from 1914 and the McKenna McBride Commission testimony to 2012 and Idle No More. And so threaded through this are ongoing questions of resistance and of home. We're sorry that there's been a bit of a change in plan, that Jordan Wilson is not speaking with us today, but we're thrilled that Gord is here. And I see Jordan's just arrived, and we were happy to have his voice as Musqueam-specific perspective on this traditional ancestral unceded territories of the Musqueam, Hunkaminam speaking peoples. But again, very happy that Gord is here. So I have short introductions before we begin, and I think that most of my introductions are unnecessary, but I will do it anyway. Marianne Nicholson is a multidisciplinary artist who works as a Kwakwaka'wakw cultural researcher and historian, as well as an advocate for Indigenous land rights. This exhibition follows on a hexam to be here always at the Belkin from 2020 and other projects, as I've mentioned. And she has major public artworks situated in her home territory of the Musqueamaw Zwan Nanook First Nation, Vancouver International Airport, the Canadian Embassy in Amman, Jordan, and the Canadian Embassy in Paris, France, amongst many others. And Gord Hill is an artist and activist, and I should say both, I think, of you identify as artist activists. Of the Kwakwaka'wakw Nation. He's the author and illustrator of the 500 Years of Indigenous Resistance comic book, which is available in our reading area to the right, anti-capitalist resistance comic book, and the Antifada comic book published by Arsenal Pulp Press. So thank you both for being here, and especially thanks to Marianne for including the Belkin in your ongoing engagement and work. So we will have this conversation, and then there'll be an opportunity for some questions, and we'll use this microphone. And the other thing I want to say is that we are recording this, so if you are uncomfortable about your voice being recorded but want to ask a question, just identify us and we can take it out. Thank you.
I'd like to thank the Belkin for hosting this event, and I'd also like to thank the Belkin for, collaborating in putting this exhibition together. I'd like to thank Gord for coming from Alert Bay to be with us today and to speak to some issues of tremendous importance regarding Indigenous activism, both from the past 100 years and forward into today. One of the things that I observed when I was sitting here looking at everyone was that it felt like both of the mural images are also participants in our discussion. These images are really present for myself in terms of having looked at them and considered them for many years. 1914, the McKenna McBride Commission was held and traveled across British Columbia, and the different nations met with the commission and gave their testimony as to their lands and their rights. In this photograph taken in Alert Bay, our chiefs of the Kwakwaka'wakw came and they brought their regalia, and they stand in this photograph wearing their regalia, which really are our legal texts that state our ownership over our lands. I think it's really powerful for us to have lived with this image for 100 years, and we know there are people in the audience who have come down from my home community of Kinkam Inlet who are the direct descendants of some of the people in this photograph. So what I hope for, I guess, is to create that direct through line from how our people were giving testimony 100 years ago through to today. And the reason why the name of the exhibition is This is an Emergency Broadcast is because I feel that that testimony is like an emergency broadcast, like a through line that carries through from 1914 to today to our contemporary generations of Indigenous peoples. And it's an incredibly important message that they were giving then that is equally important, maybe perhaps even more important for us today to hear and to listen to. I asked Gord if he would participate in putting together a comic book for our people that tells of the resistance of the Musqueam Tsleil-Waututh nations to colonization and to the theft of their lands over the last 100 years, and all that our people did in order to resist and to continue to assert who we are and our relationship to each other and to our lands. So myself and my sister Midori, and I'm really sad in my heart that Midori couldn't join us today, but she got ill. She really wanted to be here today. But so we sat down and we wrote that story. We talked to a lot of people and we wrote the story, and Gord illustrated the story. And the story is for us mainly, but it was a way to express the teachings and the understanding of our own history of resistance and keep that understanding alive. And I wanted to thank Gord, who is a relative of ours. We're related. Actually, a lot of us are related. And I want to thank everyone who's here, too, who came. That he has this personal history of resistance, activism throughout his life, and that he's channeled that into this contemporary medium of illustration and graphic storytelling that is very powerful. And one reason that it's really appealing is that it does reach younger people. And we need to be able to find ways to continue to tell our stories in contemporary ways that our younger generations will understand. Because in the long run, without our younger people, we really don't have a future. You know, like all of our teachings are that we pass down the understanding of who we are and our histories to our younger generations. So in a way, we need to take some of these modern ways of communicating and then translate our stories into these modern ways. And that's how this comic came about. And as part of what we are doing in Kingcombe, I had asked Gord if he would come to Kingcombe and share his story with our young people and to help teach them some illustration and design. And he came and we spent a few days together. And during that time, we really talked about his activism. And these were things I didn't know. And I was really educated by him in terms of what he had done, what he had participated in as a younger person. And I was really interested in his personal story in regards to how he came to be creating the books that he's written and illustrated. So Gord, I'll hand it over to you, and maybe if you want to speak to some of that.
Right. Gila Kessler, thank you, Marianne, for organizing this and for getting me to work on the comic. well, when I was a kid, I always wanted to do comics. I used to read comics like Spider-Man and Batman and that. But I would try to do comics, but I had a hard time making up characters and writing these fictional stories. And when I was a teenager, let's give a brief overview, I guess, of how when I was a teenager, I was in Army cadets, and then I joined the Army Reserve, And me and my mom moved into Vancouver, East Vancouver, and I started listening to punk music, and because there was a pretty vibrant punk rock scene in Vancouver at the time. So I started listening to this really political, radical punk music, and then I would go down to my army training, and it just seemed like I could see what the punk were talking about when I'd go down to be with my army comrades. And I'd be like, huh, they're kind of right about some of this. And I eventually left the army reserves, and I got involved in the punk scene, which is kind of like a movement. And within the punk movement, there was like an anarchist kind of faction or a sub-movement or whatever. So I became involved in the anarchist movement. The first group I became involved with wasn't actually anarchists. They were an El Salvador solidarity group, because at the time there was a revolution going on in El Salvador. So I kind of got involved with that. I helped do posters and organize events and stuff like that. And after that, I got more just involved mostly in the anarchist movement until I did some stuff with the Gitsan, because they were doing their Delgamuukw court case. So we went up to Hazleton and whatnot. But in 1990, of course, it was the Oka crisis. So I found that very inspiring to see indigenous people rising up, taking up arms, engaging in armed resistance against a modern colonial state. And because of my military training, I could understand some of the tactics and stuff that was going on. So I found that really inspiring. And after that, I kind of focused mostly on indigenous people's movements. And a couple years after that, there was 1992 was the 500-year centenary or whatever of the Columbus and the Spanish invasion of the Americas beginning in 1492. So I really wanted to understand more, so I did a lot of research about it, and I wrote a kind of a long article about the history of colonization and indigenous resistance. And that was later, that was published as a book, which was also called 500 Years of Indigenous Resistance, which caused confusion when my comics started coming up, because I got this book, now I got the comic, they all have the same name. But anyway, yeah, I did that. And so through the 90s, I was just mostly focused just on indigenous peoples. In 1995, of course, there was the siege at Chipatin, which is a Shikwemeq territory in 100 Mile House in the central interior of BC. It was like a month-long standoff between the RCMP and the Shikwemeq, like a Sundance camp. And I did solidarity work with them, and then I met all those defenders. Once the siege was over, there was a year-long trial in Surrey. It was like one of the most expensive criminal trials in Canadian history at the time. And actually, the RCMP operation was the most expensive paramilitary police operation in Canadian history. But in Surrey, we would go to court, and we listened to the testimony and all that, and I became good friends with a lot of the defenders, and I ended up moving up to the Shikwemeq territory for a while, and Nisqually, which is a small reserve, where George Manuel and his family. So some of the people involved in the different movements were the George Manuel's family. Around that time, there had been a group formed in Vancouver. It's called the Native Youth Movement, and the Native Youth Movement was mostly the children of Indigenous activists who'd been active in the 70s, like with the American Indian Movement and the Red Power Movement. So these were their children who were like teenagers and young adults. And so I met up with them, and we started organizing events and stuff like that. We'd go to protests and stuff like that, but the first big action we did was we occupied the BC Treaty Commission office in downtown Vancouver in 1997, I think that was. It was just for a couple days, though. We went back the next year on the anniversary, the same day the next year, and we occupied it for 5 days, which was a bit more of an impactful, more of a success. We did work with the Chiam, which is a small First Nation in the Fraser Valley. They're pretty militant about defending their fishing rights, but they would be harassed by the Department of Fisheries and Oceans. So we spent a summer with them acting as like a security force to deter the DFO officers from confiscating their nets and their fish and their boats and their fishing gear and stuff like that. And it was quite successful. After that, there was another Native Youth Movement chapter started with the Shikwemeq, and they were opposing Sun Peaks, which is a ski resort. They were trying to make a expansion of the ski resort. But anyway, when I was involved with the Native Youth Movement, because we're working with a lot of youth, I found like, now, there wasn't a lot of internet activity back then in the late 90s. I mean, we had internet, but not everybody had computers and access to it and stuff like that. So I was finding a lot of the young people we were working with didn't really know a lot about even the most recent acts of resistance like Oka. So I started making comics, eight or four page comics on 8x11 photocopy paper, black and white. So anytime we traveled anywhere, I could just bring a copy of these comics with me. And if we got access to a photocopier, like usually in the band office, because they're like pretty bureaucratic and they always have photocopiers. So once we got in there, we just started making photocopies of these zines, my comics. And after a while, I had a collection of them. I had the Oka comic, had the Gustafson Lake or Chipatin standoff, had Iprawash, which also occurred in 1995 when Dudley George was shot and killed by the Ontario Provincial Police. Had a bunch of little comics like that. And somebody suggested I should, if I add a few more chapters to it, we could make it a 500 years of Indigenous resistance comic book. And so I did that, and another friend of mine, he had a book published at Arsenal Pulp Press in Vancouver. So he took this copy down to them, and to my surprise, they wanted to publish it. Because I thought it was a little bit crude and a little bit violent, because, well, his colonization is such a violent history. But they had a history of publishing radical books as well, so they published the comic book. It was the first graphic novel Arsenal had ever published. So they kind of, they did a small little version on kind of like cheap paper. But it was actually pretty successful. So a lot of teachers did use it in their classroom. And I think it sold like 24,000 copies or something over the years. And then I did the anti-capitalist comic book, which is kind of similar, except it's about anti-capitalist. It was about some recent major mobilizations in the anti-capitalist, kind of anti-globalization movement. So like the World Trade Organization and the Quebec Summit of the Americas, the Vancouver Olympics, which we opposed. We had our different organizations that we were organizing a lot of actions against the Olympics. So that comic was published. And then a couple of years later, Trump was running for president in the United States, and there was this huge upsurge of far-right groups and far-right street fighting violence, which we hadn't seen really. It was kind of like a new phenomenon. So Arsenal wanted to do an anti-fascist comic book, so I said yes. And so I spent a year doing that, which was a lot of work. But that was published, and after I did that, I looked back at my 500 years of Indigenous resistance comic, and there'd been more stuff that had happened since then, like 2006, Six Nations kind of rose up and trying to stop the expansion of some condominium project on land that had been, land had been provided to the Six Nations after the American Revolution. Because they'd sided with the British, and the British lost, and they brought them up into Canada, and they gave them a tract of land in southern Ontario. So anyway, there was that, which was pretty significant, because that's the largest reserve territory in Canada. And so to see them mobilizing was pretty important. So I thought I wanted to include that in an updated version. There had been LC Pugtug with their anti-fracking campaign, which was actually successful. They were victorious. They stopped the fracking. Then there was Idle No More, and the Gitxsan, or the, sorry, the Wet'suwet'en with Unist'ot'en clan and whatnot. So there had been these more recent developments. But I also wanted to, I thought I could do a much better version because my artwork had improved. I learned how to use, to scan my artwork onto a computer and to color it and to do the text, which I didn't know when I started originally. Everything was just done by hand. Also, using better quality paper makes such a difference. It's a photocopy paper. You can get by with it, but you get some good quality paper, it's like way better. But so I thought I could do that history of indigenous resistance proper justice, and Arsenal agreed to it. And they because they published a bunch of graphic novels since the first one that we did, and they had much better quality paper as well, actually, and they did a bigger format. So I was much happier with it. And I still do comics for different zines and organizations. Like I did some comics about what they call it, fortress conservation, where national parks are constructed and they evict the indigenous people and it becomes like a tourism thing and all this stuff. Like with, I did that comic with a non-governmental organization. I just recently did a comic with the Homolko First Nation, and they did a bunch of interviews with their elders, and they wanted to make a graphic novel. So me and two other artists, we got assigned various chapters. I got hunting and food preservation. So we just finished that. They're going to publish it shortly. So that was kind of neat because they wanted to do a graphic novel because, like what Marianne has said, they think it's going to be more accessible to some of the younger people. And so it's taking the words of the elders and making it into like a comic story. So that was a pretty cool project. And they brought us up into their territory, Butte Inlet, I think it's called. And they have a bear watching kind of operation up there and that. So that was, it was really, really cool. Yeah, so I really like doing comics. I think they're a really good way of communicating, especially like complex kind of histories, like 500 years of resistance to colonialism. Things like that. So yeah, that's how I got started, and that's what I'm doing today with that.
I'm like, give me that mic. I have to say I'm really, really proud of our people. There's been so much strength and resistance, and you know, the story that Gord's telling is his own story, but there are also people here today who came down from Kinkum to be a part of things, and I wanted to acknowledge some of them. My cousin Charlene Dawson is Char. Oh, right there. I wanted to acknowledge Char. She's one of the speakers in the exhibition. We asked six women to narrate some of the testimony. We saw that many of the men were very visibly present. Our men were very visibly present through the course of all of this resistance. And we know our women were there too. So what we did was ask women to read the testimonies that you hear in the headphones as you go through the exhibit. But I asked Char to be one of the readers, and she was telling me about her advocacy when she was a young woman. And these were things I really didn't know, even though I've known Char all my life. And I was really amazed at what she had done and what she had accomplished in her youth, and really how actions like that, you know, within our communities, we don't celebrate it enough and we don't know it enough, because I think that I did not know this, you know, until fairly recently, shows that we need more things like the graphic novels and the comics and ways of communicating that share with each other our stories with each other. Today, there is so much out there that is distracting in regards to the larger world and the narratives that the larger world wants to build, and we need to continue to work to communicate amongst ourselves. And One of the things that Char did was, she went across Canada as part of, what was it called again? The longest journey? The Native People's Caravan. And she occupied a building in Ottawa for a number of months. And these are really significant histories that even we as a community, we need to know them better. We need to understand them better, because what's inundating us information-wise, sometimes it's not our own, it's not upholding our own histories. And that's part of the emergency broadcast that we need to be making from the past through to today. And the other people I wanted to acknowledge for what they have done, because there has been such a strong legacy of resistance amongst our people. I wanted to acknowledge also Melissa Willey, because she was really on the forefront of our resistance to the fish farms in our territories. So, in many ways, this exhibition is a voice back to, say, the chiefs from 1914 all the way through to Idle No More, a thank you and an acknowledgement of all of the Indigenous resistance that has been here and present and manifest through our people for so many generations. And my hope is that if we can keep these stories alive and we tell them with clarity to our young people, that our young people will carry this forward. But there's still a lot of discussion that needs to happen with our young people. It's not just learning about these histories of resistance. It's also coming to understand the strategies that are being implemented still today against us. Because one of the things that's really being implemented against us today is separation. So the nations, when you look at these images, you see the collective strength of the nations. You see the conference photograph behind you here, and you see the collective strength of the nations. But what's happening today is that strategically the nations are being separated into separate negotiation frameworks, and we're losing the sense of united collective resistance that we have had in the past, and it's something that we need to work hard to build and continue. And I guess my strategy as an activist is to try and use platforms like this, art, to reach out and communicate and create still a strong sense of community. So I'm also grateful for all the people sitting in here, because it reminds me, and one of the reasons why we use these chairs, these old chairs, is because they remind me of the old chairs that we used to have in the community center. And we would gather and sit in these chairs, which are actually really well designed compared to some of the really uncomfortable modern chairs. And it reminds me of my experiences as a young person and seeing a lot of gathering happening and a lot of discussion by the older people at the table, and we used to hang around and listen to that. And today I'm a little worried because the younger people, maybe rather than eavesdropping on what the adults are talking about, are often on their devices. And so they're getting kind of curated, in quotation marks, into a separate world, a world that lacks the sense of collectiveness that we grew up with. So those are some of the issues and concerns of today. And these are some of the strategies in place to kind of combat that. And I really have to say I enjoy looking out, seeing everyone sitting in the chairs in person. And I'm interested in other people's ideas around Indigenous advocacy today, in its relationship to how we were advocating in the past. There's also a really strong and significant relationship to the exhibition that's currently opened at the Museum of Anthropology. I highly recommend that you also visit that exhibition, because it relates to this exhibition in really significant ways. So I think I'll just ask Gord if there's anything else he'd like to share at this time, and then we could open it up to the floor.
Yeah, just briefly, I found like, so when I was talking earlier, when I wanted to do comic books, but I had a hard time making up the characters and all that. But when I really wanted to understand the history of colonialism, like how did indigenous people end up on reserves? How did we come to live under the social conditions we live under today? And I found the answers in history, right? It tells you how you came to be where you are today. So I found history to be really, really empowering because it gives you knowledge of the world you live in. So that's why I do the historical comic books. And the history of resistance is really important to movements, social movements, because you can learn a lot from the history, the different tactics and strategies that movements used. And that history is a really important part of the culture of resistance. And culture of resistance is vital for a movement to have because it gives a movement a fighting spirit. And that's what I hope to contribute with my artwork and the work that I do.
Thank you so much, Gord. There was one other person actually from my home community that I wanted to acknowledge, and I don't see her, but is Nikita Nicholson, is she in the room?
Behind you.
Oh, there's, so we started a radio station in Kinkum. It's so cute because Kinkum really, because the mountains are so high, the broadcast can't go beyond the community, so really it's a broadcast to ourselves. But in that sense, we can pretty much play anything we want. So we started the radio station about a year ago, and just wanted to thank Nikita, because Nikita, as a younger person, has really taken up the radio station, and it's a lot of technical learning that you have to do, but she's been so engaged in the radio, and also her son Max has been a part of helping with the programming on the radio, and our cultural society, Nunwakola, which Lindsay Willey, can you stick your hand up, Lindsay? That Lindsay Willey runs, what we've been doing is going to different institutions to take back, I guess, and return to the community all the old recordings of our old people so that we can play them on our radio. And then we also are using the radio as a way to play our language so that we hear our language every day. So it's really interesting, these strategies of kind of returning to, say, more basic forms of communication that have this longer history, such as radio, and illustration and newsletters. A lot of the work that, say, UBCIC encouraged through different types of publication, but really the thread running through all of that is us as Indigenous peoples communicating with each other, and that's very, very powerful for us. I'm just wondering if there's anybody at this point who would like to ask a question. I guess we can move into that part of things, yeah. Oh, like mention the comic or show? Oh, sure, the comic. I'm like, what? See, I'm not that good at communicating sometimes. Okay, hold on 2 seconds. I'll show the comic. So this is the comic that we created. It tells our story. It really celebrates our resistance and our history. I guess one of the things that happens too when you're attempting to communicate is sometimes mistakes are made. So in the introduction, there's a couple of mistakes that we're going to have to correct. but that's okay too, because what's most important is the content of the comic itself. So yeah. This is our comic. We have enough copies for our own people to receive copies of them. If you'd like a copy, just understand that there's a mistake in the introduction, so that will be corrected in the long run.
Yeah. I was going to use my longhouse voice. Hutsquile, welcome, both of you. It's really good to, actually can't even imagine like how exciting it is to have Gord Hill and Marianne Nicholson in conversation, because you two are like such groundbreaking artists from your community, and you've both been in different streams doing the same work for almost probably the same trajectory. And it's just so exciting. I was like, Billy, we have to go out and like support this. So Billy, Pierre, and I here to support you guys and T. And anyway, I was just gonna ask if there was a new comic coming out. And then, and then you kind of answered my question, but I did wanna say that I'm just so thrilled that you two are working together, because I really feel like you're both very powerful individuals and coming from the same community in different places, but the work you're doing is so impacting and so important. So, Chenkwe Mentomiwich, Haichka. I mean, I've known Gord since way back, and Marianne and I have just started to do some things together, but yeah, like Gord, like I still have some of your original works from way back, and I actually remember the day I said to you, you should write comics, and you laughed at me, and you said, I don't think so. So I actually really just had to say that to you, that I'm glad that you listened to me despite not wanting to, because I have coveted every publication that you have put out. Thank you for your work. It's so important.
Hi, I kind of missed the beginning part, so I hope I'm not asking. I hope I'm not asking something that's already been answered. But I was just wondering if both or either one of you would like to share your first experiences with making comics, your first comic.
Mm. Yeah, I started seriously trying to do a comic. I was an anti-fascist comic when I went to Germany. I went to West Germany, and I took part in a really big anti-fascist rally. And I started doing a comic, but I never finished it. I still have it, though. I have like 3 or 4 pages of it. But it's really interesting to look back at it, because I had such a different drawing style. But I think my first completed comics were those little zines I used to do, like the zigzag zine I used to do. I had little comics in that. Those were probably my first real comics, I guess.
What year was that?
I think that was like 1999. Yeah. So I was living in Bella Coola then, actually.
Thank you very much for this exhibit and for your comments. I came before and enjoyed it immensely. I'd like to go back to the issue of radio. I'm a great CBC supporter, and I get the impression that the CBC, and I learned some of the history from you, that the CBC actually provided radio in isolated communities in the North quite some decades ago. And I get the impression that today the CBC programming seems to be very supportive of First Nations, not only in its daily broadcasting, but also its digital platform, particularly GEM. And I suppose on a parallel scale, Knowledge Network. And I was just wondering if you feel that the CBC is in fact filling its mandate when it comes to supporting First Nations.
I don't know anything about radio. The one thing I know about radio is when I was living with the Shikwemeq in Nisqually, they actually started a pirate radio, and it was like this small mobile setup. It could all fit in like a guitar case, almost like a bass guitar case, and a few other, like a mixing board and stuff like that. But they would set up an antenna, and they were broadcasting to their communities of Nisqually and Adams Lake. And then we'd go to conferences, like in Penticton there was a conference, and they set up the radio station there and were broadcasting. Had a limited radius of about 5 or 7 kilometers maybe, but it would get all the community. But that's really all, that's the only experience I've ever really had with radio, like native stuff.
But Dan, do you have more radio?
I didn't know much about radio at all until we started our radio station, other than like, I had felt that, you know, because today the idea of the public voice, you know, like one of the things that I liked about the idea of the radio, the community radio, was knowing that we were listening to the same thing. There was a sense of collectiveness about that, whereas when everyone's listening to separate things, you don't have the same sense of shared experience. So I do believe in public radio, all forms of public radio, including CBC. I think we need to fight to keep those things going. For Indigenous people, I think we've been kind of appropriating all these forms for many years for the purpose of our own, resistance and collectiveness.
One thing with the with the Shikwamek, they're pirate radio, so they're trying to appeal to the whole community. But there was such a great gap between the older generation and the younger generation, because the older generation wanted to listen to like honky tonk country music, and the young generation were all like hip hop, and so that was kind of trying to find a balance with that. So they'd all be listening, but.
Unfortunately, I think the CBC is really letting down the country. Let's try this again. I think CBC is really letting down the country, especially without Afghanistan, and it never really, really stopped. But what I wanted to talk about was just before COVID, in solidarity with the Wet'suwet'en, there was like a disruption of the rail lines like across Canada. And then 2 summers ago, the Wet'suwet'en launched a very successful campaign to boycott RBC. So they're asking people to adopt an RBC bank, and you would go there like once a week for an allotment of time and do educational outreach programs about what RBC was doing. And the RBC is like by far the largest funder of the visual arts in Canada. They fund hundreds of cultural exhibitions. They gave Stan Douglas $1 million to bring his work from Vienna, Europe to North Van and then to Montreal. So there's, you know, the RBC institutions are trying to go into sovereign First Nations land pretty much all over Canada. So there will be like a reckoning of some sort. Anything you want to say about that is fine. Thank you.
There's a really... Okay. There's a really valid concern around corporatization and the co-optation of Indigenous peoples. That's looking like this is one of the reasons why work on the ground, grassroots movements, radio, self-publishing, that type of thing is vitally, vitally important to Indigenous nations. We have to be very, very careful about our relationship with corporations and co-optation by those corporate interests. And it's not just us, that's kind of everybody.
Hi, I was just, I guess, wondering if you, Marianne, could explain, so in this next room here, at the end, there's an official, reclaim of the territory and the space, and I was curious what that process was like, if that is, like, within the community, if it goes broader out of their government, if that's sort of like an alternative to the treaty process is like this method. Yeah.
Yes.
Hello? thank you for asking that. One of the positions that was put forward by the government was to highly promote negotiation frameworks and to deter nations from pursuing legal action. We, as the Zawadenoch, have a legal case, a title case. Title cases have come with their own baggage and their own issues, but it is a strategy. It is a strategy that has a benefit to all the nations, because as long as there are legal cases, that's lighting the fire under the feet of the those who would consider that our lands are crown lands. One of the things that was so sophisticated, what I was so impressed with was the sophistication of our ancestors in their approach to much of the oppression that they were facing. They were strategic. They never stopped opposing things, but they were also pragmatic. They understood when they needed to become subversive, and so we inherited that strategic positioning and that subversiveness, and I believe that our title case is part of that. There needs to be alternatives to negotiation frameworks, because the negotiation frameworks tend to separate us onto different tables, and that helps to disintegrate our collectiveness as First Nations. The artwork in the middle room really reflects that relationship to community and land that is absolutely important to us. And at the end of the day, it really seeks to uphold that the most important things are the people and the land. And unfortunately, many of the negotiation frameworks really are looking at kind of compensation dollars, benefit agreements, and none of those things resonate as far as the ability that those are financial, and that doesn't speak to the spirit of what are when I look at these old people who are long gone now in this photograph, none of that was on their minds. You know, they were really all about our history in the land, our relationship with one another, and our relationship with those lands. And they were not asking the government for compensation. They were demanding their lands. That was the primary message. Does that answer your question?
Hi, thank you so much for speaking, both of you. Incredible experience to hear you here today. I was wondering, Marianne, and like this is a half-formed question in my head, but if you could speak a little bit to the notion of coming home and the relationship between the archival photograph selection process and the relationship between archival photography, new media, and or language, and the role that like the auditory plays in this exhibition. Just kind of on those themes.
Yeah, I have a mixed relationship to the archive. On one hand, absolutely enamored of it, and on another hand, I feel frustrated with it. So through tradition, we would have been handed down our knowledge and our way of being from our family members in the land. That was disrupted, and then the colonial interest in us documented a tremendous amount about us. And in fact, the Kwakwaka'wakw are the most documented indigenous people in the world. So that's beneficial to some extent, but it comes out of this history of denial. So we've spent years now going into the archives and pulling information and pulling photographs. And I really believe our old people were astute enough to realize what was happening, to allow themselves to be recorded, knowing at some point the younger people would come and look for that information. So it's a mixed relationship. I'm both absolutely enamored of the archive and always looking for additional documentation, but also somewhat frustrated that we have to do it this way, because, you know, like, for our young people, always the most ideal way to learn would have been from their parents and their grandparents. And, you know, so today that, you know, so some of that has come down, but some of it we have to reconstitute through these other means. So it's a mixed relationship.
Hi, Gayla Kessler, Marianne and Gord. Hi. something that's come up to me is a story from my mother being attended the residential day school in Alert Bay. So when they went there, of course, they were to assimilate and learn English. But when she went home, my grandma didn't learn English until after my mom and aunts went to residential school. And so when they went home, she said, "Don't speak that language in my house. You go out there and you say that at home, you speak Kwakwala." And I'm so inspired by that, because through that was their resistance. That was their saying, "You're not going to take this from us." And my question to you, do you have any stories about your direct lineage, Marianne or Gord, of what your ancestors did to keep the culture alive and the language?
Well, my family, my closer family, most of them went to residential school except my mom. So my experience was a little different, because she was, instead of going to residential school, she had to go work in the canneries and stuff like that. But a lot of my family, they maintained the artwork. They were kind of part of that 70s revival of indigenous traditional artwork in Alert Bay. And so they became artists and were traditional carvers and painters and jewelers. And so to me, that's a really important part of our culture as well. So that's kind of like my brothers and my sister, that's what they kind of contributed more. And one of my uncles, he's like the main person people go to in Alert Bay for barbecue salmon and drying and canning salmon, which a lot of people don't know how to do in drying salmon. So he's kind of kept that tradition alive within our family and in the bigger community and that, I think, too. So there's a lot of different ways people kept traditional knowledge alive. Like your example, like that's a good one. You can't speak English in this house. I wish that had been more common, because our language probably would have survived better.
Yeah, I think that each of the individual families found ways to resist. As a young person, I think some really valuable teachings still were able to trickle down to us. We want to keep that alive. And I'm in an interesting spot now in my personal life, because I'm no longer young and I'm not old yet either. So I have to look at it at both ways. I'd like to acknowledge Dick Dawson, who came with us from Kingdom down here, and he's been with us on some of the. We went to the Museum of Vancouver. We were in the Museum of Anthropology, and while we were there, he's sharing these stories, his memories, and it's really wonderful to hear people remember, because I learn a lot from looking in the archive, but I also learned from from older people who would share, who would tell their stories, and Dick still has that old way of telling stories, and he's teaching while he's handing that information down, and that's how our old people did it. And so I think each of the families, and this is what I found even when we were when we listened to all the old recordings, it's like each of the families found a way to keep part of that story of us alive. And really then it's only really living when it's collective, when we're all a part of it. So, which is really different from contemporary society where people want to own everything, one person own everything, you know, instead of recognizing that we really need each other and we're so much richer with one another. And in fact, no one person can be absolutely everything, nor should we try. So,
one more if somebody wants to share.
Gaila Kasla, Nugwa'am Mo Dawson, Nugwa'am Hayam Sandalayu. I'm from Gitsan First Nation on my mother's side and Zawadenuk First Nation on my father's side. I just want to say thank you, Marianne and Gord, for being here and sharing a bit of your stories. I'm from the territory, from the community as well, and it's very inspiring for me to hear, you know, and to see, you know, what has been done for decades and for hundreds of years. And I feel like your guys' work shows what is possible as well. And my question for Gord, the illustrator of the comic book, the Kinkum comic book, is, was there any kind of formal training as far as illustration work, comic book creation, arts-based storytelling, or was it kind of just self-taught and like this natural talent or natural skill and ability that led you to creating the comics that you have?
Yeah, I have absolutely zero training, so I just kind of learned it as I went along. And I mean, after I did the first one or two comics, I thought I needed to work on some of my stuff, so I self-studied like anatomy a bit more, and then studied like a bit more about how comics are, like how different comic artists approach doing panels and how they try to make the art flow through their panels on a page and how they lay out pages and stuff like that. So yeah, I just started studying more. YouTube has a lot of really great comic artists on there sharing like little tutorials on how they do stuff. So I found that, I still look at that stuff today because you always can improve. So that's where I get a lot of my knowledge from. I just learned it all myself, self-taught.
Thank you both.
Lord.
Back up and running.